You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, listen, I don't usually have poets on my show, and I have nothing against poetry. I love poetry, but it's usually not like the right fit or something, or people send me their poetry and it's not good. So I think I've either had one or two poets on my show. So this will be like my third poet in 8 years. So I'm just telling you, it's a big deal. Like, I really like this person's work. Let me tell you who she is. Arielle Greenberg is the author of 5 collections of poetry and the creative nonfiction book Locally Made Panties, and co-author with Rachel Zucker of Home/Birth, a Poemic. She has also co-edited 3 literary anthologies, and her poems and essays have been featured in Best American Poetry, Labor Day, True Birth Stories by Today's Best Women Writers, and The Racial Imaginary, among other anthologies. A nonfiction book on non-normative sexuality is forthcoming from Beacon Press. You know I'm going to have her back on the show for that.
Yeah.
She edited a series of essays called Kink with K in the parentheses, ink. You can tell she's an academic. Writing While Deviant for the Rumpus. A former tenured professor in poetry at Columbia College, Chicago, she lives in Maine, where she works as an editor and teaches in the community. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Arielle.
Thank you so much. I have been listening to your podcast since the start. When you said 8 years, I was like, oh yeah, 8 years ago is when I started listening to Sex Out Loud.
Oh my God.
Yeah, totally. And your work has been like literally life-changing for me. So it's so exciting to be here. And I'm so honored to be one of 3 poets. And I totally get it, because I wrote this book because I couldn't find poems about this stuff either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's first talk about your big move from the city of Chicago to the country, as you call it, but in the book, in Maine. This was a huge transition. This is like the plot line for a major network's TV sitcom. but you portray it differently. So let's talk about what brought you to do that, and how did you make it work?
Yeah. What brought me to do it was that my second pregnancy ended in a stillbirth. And when that baby died, it was, you know, we had been living in Chicago, and then we came to Maine actually to have that baby, who then was stillborn. Before we actually came back to have him, he died in utero at 31 weeks. And then we flew to Maine in a snowstorm and waited for me to go into labor. And it was a life-changing event in so many ways. And as these things sometimes are, it ended up being like a huge gift of clarity of like what was important to me and what I wanted in life. And my husband at the time and I had gotten married in this small town in Maine, and we'd been vacationing here. And then we had this baby, we had a baby in Maine, and that baby died, and we buried him in Maine. And it just really felt like the universe was saying to us, hello, like, this is where all important things in your life happen. Why are you not here? And I had, you know, his my first child was a toddler, and we quickly got pregnant again by accident after the second child. And so I was pregnant again. And I just, you know, I was teaching full time, tenured in Chicago, and I loved my job. I loved my students, but because I was teaching mostly grad classes, they were often at night, and I wasn't getting home until like 11 o'clock at night sometimes, and it was just kind of crazy. And then we lived in a perfectly lovely neighborhood, just over the Chicago Evanston border. But my daughter at one point said to me, she was like four, and she was like, "How old do I have to be before I can go to the ice cream shop down the block by myself?" And I was like, 21. Because
I was just thought, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there had been a sexual assault directly behind our like co-op condo apartment. And, you know, there was frequent robberies. And yeah, it was just not ideal. Plus, I mean, I did actually really love Chicago, but all the reasons I love Chicago and the great stuff there, like the theater and the music scene and the food, I was not taking part in because I had young children. So it just started seeming a little crazy. And we realized that we were struggling to get by on two professional salaries in Chicago and on just one salary, because my husband at the time worked from home and could work anywhere, we would be doing a lot better in Maine. So, and that I was employable in other things. So I sort of like worked part-time while my kids were really little, and then kind of like just kept, you know, adding on work as they got older. So, yeah.
Okay, but you make it sound, you're not filling in the details here.
It's true.
Which is like, you live in a rural area, you're like churning your own milk. Or do you even churn milk? No, you churn butter. It's like this very sort of crunchy granola place. You're doing a sort of bougie type of living off the land.
Well, we are and we aren't. So yeah, I mean, what happened was we moved to Maine, and like in the poetry community and people who knew me in academia were like, "Oh, you guys, you've become you're a dropout from academia and you're a blueberry farmer." And I was like, "No, I live in town in a rural place. And like, I have a garden, I grow some vegetables, but I am by no means a farmer." I mean, you know, we had thought about buying some actual land. It's a very rural county that we live in. A lot of our friends are actually farmers and homesteaders who live off the grid and stuff. But we kind of looked into it. We did our research and we were like, "Nope, we are the bushy people who will write about that, but we are not those people." So yes and no. I mean, I would say like compared to my big city life, for sure, it looks pretty different, but in other ways, not so much. And then in one really big way, it looked different, which is that when we moved here, we opened our marriage, and that was like a cascading a domino effect of all sorts of interesting sexual exploration for me that happened afterwards.
Yes. So one thing that made me so happy is that I would imagine a certain kind of more isolated life socially. And you have proven in this book that you can be non-monogamous in the country. So Heads up, folks. I want to shout out to all the people who are in places with very small populations and they're still doing it. In this book, you're having a lot of sex. More sex than some people I know who live in urban areas. I can't imagine, you know, you growing on Tinder and there being like 3,000 people to choose from. Just a thought.
Yeah, no.
So did you think that would happen? Did you think as you were opening up, you thought, oh, and the partners, I mean, there's a full stock of them.
Right. No, definitely not. I mean, I think what we thought when we opened our marriage and, well, really what I thought, because I brought the idea to the table, and we had some close friends who are ethically non-monogamous, so we had some good models in our life. But we, you know, basically what happened is I stopped having babies after basically spending my whole 30s pregnant or birthing or nursing, and then looked up and was like, "Hey, I'm like kind of at the peak of my sexual, I was probably at the end really of my like reproductive phase, and my hormones were going kind of nuts, as often happens for people with estrogen at that point in your life. And I'd always been a sexually curious person who also has identified as a fetishist since early childhood. Like, I'm one of those people who's like, this is my sexual orientation. It felt so kind of bigger than me always. Like, I can remember, you know, 5 years old, 7 years old. Like, it's, I have the, had the same like core non-normative sexuality since childhood. And I never really got to explore that. I'd always been a serial monogamist and with cisgendered men. And I also knew that I was queer. I like kind of came to knowing that I was queer early on as well. And so, yeah, so I was just like, hey, I'm done having kids. I'm in my late 30s. Like, I've got things I want to do, like, sexually. And I just kind of like really pursued it pretty hard, but I mean, mostly not locally, which, you know, I write about in some of the poems. Like, I had to go to the city too.
But what about the boy? The boy was local.
The boy was home from college visiting family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Right. Keep going.
And I mean, the biggest thing really that happened, I mean, you know, both my husband and I started seeing other people, but I got back in touch with a lover that I'd had in my 20s. And that got very serious very fast. And he ended up moving up to Maine. He had not been here. His marriage was already sort of at its end, and he got separated and divorced and moved up here. And then he moved in with my husband and my kids and I, and we all lived together for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
There isn't a poem about that.
No.
Not in this book. Maybe not in this book.
Right. I mean, I do. You can find writing about that. I've talked about it in other places, but, and we were, you know, it was really well known. It's a really small town. So we weren't trying to hide it. And the best story about that is that my kid's guidance counselor from school, you know, she was in elementary school, and the guidance counselor called me and she's like, I need to speak to you. And my husband picked up the phone. She was like, I need to speak to Ariel. And he was like, okay. And he passed me the phone and I was like, oh shit, here it comes. Like, they're going to ask some question. And she was like, I forget what the question was, but it was like, can you send an extra pair of underwear for your kid to school? You know, like, whatever.
Right,
and I was like, oh, and she was a really nice person. So I was like, I thought you were going to ask about the like fact that I'm living with my husband and my boyfriend. And she was like, oh no, we all know that.
I mean, Maine does have a certain.
It does.
It has a certain live and let live quality to it.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. And we live in a sort of hippie bubble of a town. I mean, not exclusively. There's plenty of Trump folks here, but yeah, I mean, I think, and the truth is, as you and I both know, I'm sure, like, people have been doing this actually forever. The truth is, like, I am by no means a groundbreaker by living with multiple partners as a woman writer. Like, that literally happened 100 years ago with Virginia Woolf and, you know, Anais Nin and like a bunch of other a bunch of incredible women writers were doing this a century ago. So, and I'm sure before that too, we just don't always know about it.
So the book we're going to talk about today, which is your latest book, is called I Live in the Country and Other Dirty Poems. They are dirty poems.
Yeah.
They are very, very dirty. I enjoyed this book immensely. They're also smart and beautifully written and stuff. But they're dirty. And so I want to give listeners a taste of the book. So you're going to read some pieces throughout the show, and I think now's a good time to take a break and read one.
Great. Let's do that. Yeah, and I will just say before that that was like a rule I gave myself in writing these poems, because I really wasn't finding. I was doing a lot of reviews of poetry books professionally, and I was teaching a lot of contemporary poetry to my students, and I was just not finding any work about feminist sexual pleasure. There's definitely work about sexual trauma, which is extremely important, and of course, I'm really glad it's out there. but there was a few books by gay men about sexual pleasure, but otherwise I would say there was like nothing. And even the books that were blurbed as being like sexy, dirty books, I was like, wait, I would read the book and I'd be like, wait, where? What did I miss? Where's the sex? Like, where's the sexual explicit material?
Right.
So I was like, there has to be something sexually explicit, like downright pornographic in every single poem. I gave myself that as a parameter for the work.
You accomplished it.
Thank you. I'll read Queers. I'll start there. Queers. I drove the country roads past creatures with their red cataract glint hovering in front of them in the bushes, to a red theater to sit with the other queers. I am scratched to flame by testosterone, and I like the idea of you on tea and the barrage of what may come with it, the up against the wall of it, though that is not always how it goes. In the red theater, the girls in their red spangled pasties and black false eyelashes, and the girls in their black ties and black trousers, and M, who removed his awkward black slip dress and awkward black wig to show how he'd also removed his breasts, and then knelt on the stage and rubbed the cock he wants so well there in his black boxer briefs, that my red lacquered mouth parted and I leaned forward in my velvet seat. When I slip into my red platform Mary Jane's, I am enacting a gender of my own devising, a costume that feels more like me than skin. I want to feel it. I want it to feel extreme. I want the physics of ache, the good pain of having consciously asked for and earned it. I mean, tweak it for me. Tweak it hard. I will not default. Mostly, I am utterly choosing femme. I choose it when I take the large steel hedge trimmers with the red handle and fasten my black and red silk corset and go out into the yard this sunny afternoon to do the gardening with a very good posture. I am examining my girl. I relish it. I like how I can feel the steel bones of it for hours after I remove it. Do you know who I want? I want you, whose hips are the gender you've been dreaming about forever, like mine become when you cinch me tighter. I mean, I just want you to be thinking about it all the time, your fingers hot and slippery as you lace yourself up into it. Your little black dress, the big fly flap on the front of your red football pants. As long as you're into it, I'm into it. As long as I can see how you wear it so well. As long as we can breathe into each other's mouths. I'm sorry it took me all those years of fucking nothing but straight vanilla boys to realize that what I want most to fuck is attitude enacted. I want to fuck you because you've practiced how to walk like that, how to ditch drop your voice, because of the way you constantly mess with your black hair. I want to fuck your jump-started, your amped-in, your dragged-out selfhood. It's a little red and black velvet theater with the lights out. Let me go put on my lipstick.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. If you're into it, I'm into it. It's a really great line. Okay. I want people to just like have a minute to breathe and chew on that. Let's take a commercial break. When we come back, more with Ariel. Stay with us. Hey, everyone. You know, we're all trying to be healthy and achieve balance in our lives. But one thing you might be forgetting is your Kegel exercises. With Intensity by Pour Moi, you'll be excited to work out your pelvic floor muscles. Intensity is a sexual health and stimulation device that looks like a vibrator, but it is so much more. It actually tightens and tones your pelvic floor muscles and vagina. People are always talking about Kegels, but where are those muscles and how do you exercise them and how do you do it right? The Intensity by Pour Moi uses muscle stimulation along with the resistance of the inflatable part to safely pinpoint those muscles, and it will exercise them automatically for you. Pour Moi is offering our listeners an additional $25 off of Intensity when you go to pourmoi.com and enter the code Tristan at checkout. You can use this code along with any code on their website. That's $25 off on top of all ongoing promotions when you go to PourMoi.com and use promo code Tristan. PourMoi.com, code Tristan. Intensity by PourMoi. Kegels with a kick. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking to Arielle Greenberg about her newest poem collection, I Live in the Country and Other Dirty Poems. So, Arielle, animals play a central role in many of these poems. And I wondered if you wanted to talk about that.
Sure. I don't know how many people listening have seen the, in my opinion, extremely underrated film, Human Nature. It's like a super weird, I forget now if it's like Michelle Gondry or Spike Jones, or like one of them, those two is involved in it. But, you know, it's a movie that it's like too weird to explain. But basically, the thesis is like, we're animals. Humans are animals. We're primates. And we're actually extremely close to our primate brethren. And I told you that one of the rules I gave myself with writing these poems is that they would be explicitly sexually dirty and pornographic in the sense of like aiming to arouse. And the other rule I gave myself is that they would be aware of the environment, the natural environment and the ecology, because of these sort of like misperceptions of what it meant that I moved to the country, and that I wanted to kind of explode those notions of what it means to live in the country, both in terms of sex, the sex that one can have or the sex that one can be thinking about, as well as about sort of like the bucolic or, you know, idyllic version of that. It never existed probably, but also especially now that the poet Juliana Spahr has this great line about how if you're going to write a nature poem these days that notices a bird, it also needs to notice the bulldozer nearby. And I really took that to heart as well. So in a lot of these poems, I'm really thinking about sexuality as a basic animal instinct that we have, that we share with other mammals, other animals, and not to separate ourselves so much from that, not to think that we're somehow better than or different than other species in that way.
So that might be a good lead-in to reading another poem to us.
Sure. Yeah, okay, this one has animals in it. Desire. I think good. They all have animals in them.
Okay.
Desire, perhaps from the Latin, meaning from the stars. If this were a performance piece and I were here in my guise as clairvoyant or derby girl or park ranger, I would start with you on the inside of my body, crawling outward. I would lift my skirt. I would have a skirt. I would have a skirt made of newsprint, a skirt made of mustache, a skirt made of bourbon, a skirt made of, quote, vexed feminine heteronormative desire. In the performance piece of this poem, I would sing the date rape drug lyrics from Blurred Lines, and in so doing, would queer the lens and be the good girl who actually does want it. I would turn my backside to you and show you how, as a white girl, I'm succeeding in my utter failure to twerk. In the performance version, you would be the audience as consensually DP'd. There would be a carefully pre-negotiated cathartic gangbang in the middle, right here. And then aftercare. We would all be dressed like animals with animal masks. This means we would all be undressed and happy and sniffing each other without antiperspirant. No one in the bookstore or theater would be wearing talc or aluminum. This means we'd all be skyclad, which would mean that in the performance piece, we'd drink from the same glass of past wine and burn our regrets in a straw effigy. I want to do the performance of this poem in which I lie down in the middle of this room, in which, to form a middle, we form a circle of people. No, in the real version, we'd be in the middle of a clearing, the middle of a meadow, the middle of a stamen. I'd project at you from the middle of pollen. Then I'd pause here and masturbate to orgasm, using only interior muscles you can't see unless, again, you were listening from within my body, which you could be. I could hold up to 65 listeners on the inside of my body for this piece. I could bring down the stars.
That was a good one too. That, well, I picked some favorites. So, okay. I want to go right into another one. What do you think is a good pairing with that one?
Another one you had chosen is, I Have to Leave the Country, which we were just talking about. So maybe we'll do that one.
Okay.
Oh yeah. That's a good one for that. I Have to Leave the Country. In order to have the sex I want, I have to leave the country for the weekend and go to the city where we are feral, human. Standing in the elevator machine in the hotel by the harbor full of gulls and ships, my bones and skin just in front of your bones and skin, we are still two human animals inside a bright metal box. So when you press your hard primate side inside its soft layers of clothing, against my slippery primate side inside its soft layers of clothing, I immediately back up into you without thinking and rub and slide along you as we ascend through the hotel by the harbor full of lights and animals to pace down the carpeted hallways to our corner room where we turn off all the electricity and build a little fire on the nightstand so I can crouch on all fours and scream into something dark and furred and out of doors.
Okay, there's a lot of hotels in this too.
Yeah, yeah.
I got because you know because you have to travel around to like meet and have sex with these people.
And also I have kids, so it's
right. Easier. So it's like you're not like bringing them back to the house. Right. So I want to read a little piece and talk about it. This is just a little part of one poem. I forget the title and I didn't write it down. Oh my gosh, Tristan. That's okay, you'll know what it is when I say it.
Maybe. Who knows?
Okay. Who knows? Okay. So this is your piece of your poem. Afterward, in the weird liquid light of the marble bathroom, I looked in the mirror and saw how I'd dissolved. I felt marathon good, new tattoo good, birthing good, triumphant, enduring, burning with adrenaline. My mouth was swollen and my makeup fuck smeared into ditches below my dilated eyes. I looked like an iced and slightly crushed slice of cake. I looked like the victor, my spoils in my teeth. I looked blurred to calm by bliss. Okay, so that's like one of my favorite, like we'll call it a stanza. What, I don't know. Yeah. What do we call it? Poetry teacher.
Right.
Okay, great. Stanza. Great.
hey, okay. For you.
So thank you. So first of all, that's just, I look like an iced and slightly crushed slice of cake. I mean, I will like never forget that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It's so good. But what this brings up, which is a kind of theme, a thread in the book, is you're talking about desires, fantasies, and actual sex where you are submissive with men and masculine folks. And it seems like you are also wrestling with this as a feminist.
Yeah, or I would say I'm trying to explain to other feminists how it's possible or okay. I mean, I don't, I feel like it's so central to my sexuality to be a sort of service-oriented sub or, yeah, I mean, there's other things I can call it, I guess. It's maybe not like the most traditional kind of submission, but, or the most like commonly discussed kind of submission, but, you know, it's like pretty comfortable for me. It's definitely my zone, but I'm well aware as a lifelong feminist, like how problematic that can seem to other people. So I'm, and even my editor, I'll say like when I, you know, after they took this book and I was working with my editor, who's a wonderful woman, you know, there were many like margin notes where she'd be like, wait, how, why is this okay? Like, can you explain, like, you don't really mean that you got slapped across the face, do you? Like, and I'd be like, yes. So yeah, I mean, I wanted to write it definitely for people like within the kink community and the ethical non-monogamous communities, but also for people not in those communities, because those were a lot of the people who, when I was talking about my life, you know, with friends, they were just like, what the fuck? What are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, no, I think this is an ongoing debate within feminism around, you know, it got started probably in the 70s and certainly came to a head in the 80s where this was, I mean, there were entire conferences about it, right? So like the Barnard Conference. But there's this assumption that dominance and submission, especially when it's heterosexual or heterosexual seeming, and it's between a cis man and a cis woman, or a masculine person and a feminine person, that it's a replication of the patriarchy, that it can't possibly, you know, Andrea Dworkin would say, it can't possibly be anything else.
That's right.
Except that you've been duped.
Yep.
And now you're acting it out.
Yep.
But it's more complicated than that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm definitely of the belief, as I'm sure you are too, of like the idea that there is no such thing, that power exchange can only exist if both or all people involved have power to exchange. And so one has to be in a relationship in which they hold power in order to choose to hand over that power temporarily. And that we're also all in non-consensual power exchange relationships all day long, every day, with our like employers and colleagues and family members and strangers and all sorts of things.
Right.
And that it is like actually hugely transformative to choose to play with that power within like a negotiated, enthusiastically consensual space where everybody knows the rules and you can step out of it afterwards. Because of course, we can't step out of all of the non-consensual power exchange we're in all day long, every day. You know, and I definitely, I know that as a woman, and certainly I know how that is for people of color in this country and, you know, so many other factors, so many other populations who are just like locked in spaces where they don't have a choice around like how their power is being taken from them. So like, what an amazing thing to get to choose to play with it erotically and temporarily, like within these trusting relationships.
But you've said, your editor aside, that even friends of yours have, you know, sort of stepped back or clutched their pearls about this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, I think it's still really, I mean, I, you know, I have some poems about, I try to speak to this in the book, but like, I'm not, I'm fully aware that that I'm writing these poems like within the rape culture and within the patriarchy. And that's, you know, I like to call it sort of like the possible impossible or something. Like, I have to also believe that within that there is space for my own sexual pleasure, however I want to define that. Because what's the alternative? That there's none? You know, like that would suck worse than just being trapped in the rape culture and the patriarchy.
Well, and I think, I mean, others have said this before, so this is not a new idea. But I think also the idea that feminists would get into bed and want to enact these power exchanges, but on their own terms, and like fuck around with them and explore them. You know, our sex is not happening in a vacuum, right?
So it
sort of makes perfect sense that if we're out in the world as women experiencing this bullshit every single day, that we might want to take some space to rewrite the narrative, to center our pleasure, to center our desires, within those same things, though, within those same dynamics that we, again, see out in the real world, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes I will say to my partner, like, fuck me like you don't care about me. Because that's like sort of the scariest thing, right? That because obviously the culture doesn't care about me as a woman in a lot of ways. But this particular partner, I know, like, cares about me more than anything and like always has my best interests in mind. And so, you know, it's a subversive thing to ask him to do that, to like tell him that's okay to do that. And for both of us, it's like a really liberating space because he's also not a person who would ever want to do that, like in any other context, obviously, who would never want to you know, who actually kind of falls in love with every single person he fucks, because that's the kind of person he is, you know.
Yes.
If somebody's willing to let him fuck them, he like loves them forever with utter gratitude and respect.
That's very sweet. That's very sweet. Now, I've heard this from other people, and I know from experience. Have you ever run into a guy or a masculine person, guy defined on whatever fucking terms, that is like, you want me to do what? No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my first marriage was to a guy who read Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon in college in women's studies classes that he took, because he's that kind of man who took women's studies classes in the 80s in college. And he was like totally, he's never recovered, like in a way. Like, I mean, I think he really can't access a space for his masculinity that feels like safe and okay to him. I think there's so many men like that. Good men, right? Like men who are trying to be good, who are trying to not, who are like not rapists and who really, you know, do respect women. And yeah, I mean, the first weekend I went away with this other partner when I was still married, you know, I came home and my husband and Rob, I asked Rob, like, what do you want to hear about this weekend? You know, tell me what you want to know and what you don't want to know. And he said, well, what I most want to know, like, I want to know like one really amazing moment that, you know, like a moment that was really kind of powerful for you. And I said, one moment that was really powerful for me is when I started to walk up the stairs with Mike, and Mike was like, wait, I'm going to stand at the bottom of the stairs and you walk up so I can watch you walk up the stairs from behind. And I said this to Rob, and Rob was like, horrified. I mean, the look on his face, and he was just like, who would say that? You know? And I was like, Mike would say that, you know?
Right.
I mean, it would never, like, Rob could never, you know? And I think many men are in that boat. And, you know, of course we're like doing a disservice to all people of all genders and all sort of orientations by pathologizing like healthy expressions of masculinity and of femininity and of androgyny and like everything in between. Like there's no sort of gender expression or sexuality our culture has not pathologized. And so for all of us, I feel like we're kind of like always trying to figure out where is a space where I can express this fully and safely and healthfully, you know? Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm a feminist who loves reverential objectification. Like I love it. I totally adore it. And I think that's there's a big difference between that and of course something that's like disrespectful and misogynist.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know a bunch of people who are into objectification. I've talked a lot about it. And you know, there is this element of objectification wherein you are the center of attention, but you asked to be the center of attention. So it's not like when you're walking on the street and people like yell out the car, right? That's just awful. But in fact, you've set up a situation whereby you can claim I'm the object here and you're going to, everything's going to sort of revolve around me. And that itself for women, we don't have spaces in our lives in society where we can say, hey, this is all about me. This is going to revolve around me. And men especially say, okay.
Right. Well, also where we can just feel seen and have that feel safe and respectful and like without any assumptions or demands. I mean, when I was in my 20s and I lived in New York City, like I got catcalled a lot. And, you know, I mean, I will say for the most part, it was like relatively harmless. It was mostly a lot of men being like, why don't you smile? You know, like whatever, that whole thing, like whichever, whatever. It's not good, but it's like, it wasn't terrifying to me either. But there was always that moment where even like, a sort of seemingly nice guy, or he would just be like, you look pretty today or whatever, like a genuine compliment. But then there was always the sense like this could turn at any second. Like I better walk a little faster. I better turn the corner soon. Like I better, you know, you don't know. Like it's just, it's not like on the one hand, or they'd be like, that shirt looks great on you. And I would in my head be kind of like, thanks. Like I really want this shirt to look great on me today. And then there'd be the flip side of that would be like, oh fuck, are you going to rape me now? So, you know, I think women not all women, I'll speak for myself. Like, I want to be seen in the world. Like, I want to be visible. If I put on a good outfit, I want to know it looks good. I want to know that, like, you know, the effort I made to do my hair or whatever paid off, but I don't obviously want my life to be in danger because of it. And that's like a stupidly, you know, fine line in this culture that, like, shouldn't be a fine line at all, but is, unfortunately.
Okay. We're going to take another break. This is our last break, guys. You know, I am to bring you less commercials, and I hope you appreciate it. I got your feedback. I'm listening. So stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk more about some of these issues that you really bring to the fore in your book. And then we also have to talk about motherhood and also the new book you're working on. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. And I'm one of them. Calm is the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. Now more than ever, our world requires that we have tools for anxiety reduction, self-care, mindfulness, and healthful sleep. All of these things have helped me get through what is still a really difficult time on multiple levels. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories narrated by soothing voices like Kate Winslet, Chike Okonkwo, Harry Styles, Laura Dern, and Idris Elba. I mean, who doesn't want Idris Elba talking in their ear holes as they fall asleep? Oof. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library, and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/TRISTAN. That's calm.com/Tristan. Get the Calm app and experience a transformation in the way you sleep. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with the poet and writer Arielle Greenberg. I've been just relishing her new book called I Live in the Country and Other Dirty Poems. Let me tell you, that title, it's a little wholesome. It's a little misleading. There's a little Trojan horse quality to it. So don't think, oh, I live in the country. That sounds quaint. Because once you find out what she does in the country and elsewhere, it's fucking filthy in the best way. In Yay. The best way. Okay. So I'm going to ask this question and then I want to reflect on the question and then you can answer it. That sounded very dommy, but that's how we're going to do it. Okay.
It works for me.
Great. Okay. So I think there's a tension in your writing about breaking free of the bonds of things like heteronormativity, mononormativity, slut shaming, and yet reveling in things like naughty schoolgirl outfits, on your knees blowjobs, lifting your skirt to get fucked really hard. And as I reread this question this morning, I thought, it's interesting because I want to be conscious about how I frame things. And in fact, that may be a tension for me, but that might not be a tension for you. So I was like, I'm asking you about a tension that may not exist. And in framing the question, I'm sort of, so I want to also be cognizant of the fact that the answer to this could be like, there is no tension.
No, I think there totally is a tension.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that, you know, I wrote these poems. We opened our marriage. My ex-husband and I opened our marriage in 2012. I would probably write some really different poems right now. You know, when I first started exploring, there was a lot of DS, power exchange stuff happening that I was really interested in kind of like getting under my belt. And I was definitely thinking a lot about sort of this category of femme too, and like how to finally really embrace that for the first time in my life, like completely, when that is something that I, that's a tension that I've had since I was a little kid. I mean, my mom was a second wave feminist in the 70s and dressed me in like overalls and, you know, all thought like, you know, this is what you do when you're a good feminist mother of a little girl. And all I wanted was like a petticoat and some patent leather Mary Janes, like all I wanted in the world. And I really struggled with that. I was like, what does this mean about me? Is that bad? Like, am I a bad feminist? And, you know, I came of age in the 70s and 80s. So that tension was everywhere. And it was like in all the culture I consumed as well. There was like, I was watching, you know, shows and movies and listening to Free to Be You and Me and all the stuff that was like promoting egalitarianism and, you know, liberation from all of that stuff. And then at the same time, like it was the 70s. So there was also like, I was watching Hee Haw and like looking at my dad's Playboys and these like super feminine, you know, not just femme, but like ditzy blonde portrayals that were everywhere. Like I was obsessed with Charo on the Love Boat in the 70s. Like Charo was like, I was like, what is this dream of like campy femininity?
Well, I was going to say to me, Charo read as very queer.
Yeah, totally.
Because it was so high camp and she was in on the joke.
Yeah, completely.
You know, whereas I mean, like Lonnie Anderson, right, like on WKRP was maybe not.
Right. I wasn't so interested in her. Like I was definitely interested in what I later came to recognize as like femme representation.
Yeah.
Rather than just like this unfiltered, you know, or unconsidered version of feminine, of like normative femininity. But that, you know, and then I was a teenager, a college student during Riot Girl, and I was involved with Riot Girl. And so that was really interesting to me too. I mean, you know, in my early 20s, I wore like baby barrettes and Mary Jane Doc Martens and stuff.
I'm right there with you. And yeah. I have the photos to prove it. Yep.
Me too. And I mean, that made a lot of sense to me too, which was not just about, like, it was about girly stuff. And that really appealed to me. And it still does. You know, I think that there is something about my sexuality that is kind of about that representation of femininity, which is a really, you know, weird one. Like it's not, it's not the mainstream one in some ways. And then, I mean, I think like,
It's like,
right,
you know, hot young teens is, you know, in the top 10.
Sure.
Young girl kind of fantasy is in the top 10 of like porn watch, you know,
right,
the porn people.
Right.
Watch.
Yes. But I was always most interested in the category of sort of like the cock tease because she had, I think that, and also I will say that that's sort of where my sort of S type submission lies, is in, you know, this sort of object, this objectified girl who also has the, like, I was always so fascinated by that. Even when I read my dad's Playboys, I was like, wait a minute, like to my young feminist mind, I was like, these women have, this centerfold has enormous power because everybody wants her and she's like gorgeous and she's being held up as this like, in, you know, dream creature. And so to my mind, I was like, well, doesn't that mean she has all the power? And, you know, like in some ways yes and no, obviously it's much more complicated than that in the real economy of sex work adjacent stuff. But, there's part of that I've always kind of been like, yeah, if you kind of retain that that status as an object of desire, then that's a certain kind of power.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can wield it. You can choose when to give it out or not.
I'm going to shift gears here. I didn't know about your stillborn baby, and I'm really sorry for that loss. That came out of nowhere for me because I didn't do my research, I guess, well enough.
No problem.
So motherhood is all over this book. I feel like asking one question about motherhood sort of doesn't do justice. And you're very, very, very much challenging. I mean, still in 2021, we got this ideas of who a mother is, and she's pure and she's chaste and she is not sexual. Absolutely not sexual. She doesn't have desire. No one desires her. I mean, it's so fucked up. And you can't believe we haven't gotten past that. So one of the details that comes out in one of your poems is, I'm paraphrasing you, but it was something about, you know, your first pregnancy was planned and the other two came from the way I wanted to fuck.
Yep.
I'm paraphrasing here, but let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when I stopped nursing my daughter, my oldest child, I felt my libido come back in this way that I always describe as like being dragged around by the collar or something. Like I would just be in public and I would be like overwhelmed by, like I would just see a stranger and be like, let's do this thing. I mean, I didn't actually do that, but I felt like my body was really... like my, you know, and I don't want to be like biologically determinist about this, but there was definitely something that because I was trying to not get pregnant, and tracking my cycle and my ovulation, I could see that around my fertile time of each cycle, I would just go into this like sexual overdrive. And I would really have to say to my husband, like, stay away from me. Like, you know, I could get pregnant at any second. And we would try very carefully to not have sex during those times of the month, and we didn't, and I would get pregnant anyway. Like I'm one of those fertile people.
there is a hormonal. We don't need to be, you know, we don't need to be absolutists about this, but there is a hormonal component here.
Yes,
right.
For sure.
I mean that, like you went through pregnancy, your hormones are shifting, and then but. And people have said, you know, they were the horniest during their pregnancy or in the first trimester, in the last trimester. You know, it's different for everyone.
Yes, yeah.
And also, I think there's some evolutionary drive in there, which is that you feel the horniest when you're the most fertile so that we can like replicate the race or whatever that means.
Well, we're animals. I mean, we're just mammals. Like,
right.
Yeah, it's a mammalian. It's a survival skill to try to mate while you're fertile, for sure.
But now that we have a overpopulation problem, it's not serving us that well.
No.
Okay. So you've got a forthcoming nonfiction book. It's on non-normative sexuality. So I want to talk about that. What's the book about? What's it like? When is it coming out?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. It's due to Beacon Press a year from now in the winter 2022. So it'll be sometime after that. So it's a little while away. I'm still not very much in the writing process. But it's very exciting that I was approached by an editor at Beacon who was when she got hired there, she was sort of given the opportunity to like bring in some books that she felt were really important. She was already the editor of a book on asexuality that just came out. And she decided that she really wanted to publish a book about kink that was like a sort of thoughtful book that she hadn't really seen out there in the world that was not a memoir and not an anthology. And like your book is like all over our proposal. The Ultimate Guide to Kink is, you know, I recommend it to everybody. And like whenever somebody's like, where do I find thoughtful writing about kink? I'm like, Tristan's book, this book, this anthology, but it's an anthology. So it's like every, you know, piece is by a different author and they're all in different voices. So she was like, would you want to, she found me because of the series I edited for The Rumpus about kink and writing, and approached me and said, do you want to write a book about this? That's not a memoir and not a how-to and not an academic book, but like some kind of nonfiction that's in between all of those things. And I said, oh my God, yes. And so it's a book about kink and BDSM and fetishes And that there's a lot of, you know, research in there, but it's not an academic book. And there's a lot of me in there, but it's not a memoir. And it's sort of somewhere. And, you know, I'm really writing it with the idea that it could both be read by somebody who's brand new to all this stuff. And it'd be, you know, all the terms are defined and like mm-hmm. you can, you know, understand things. But also if you're very far along in this stuff, you will also find kinship and, you know, recognize, like feel validated and visible and spoken to as well. And I'm certainly learning things, you know, I know a lot of stuff. I've been researching this stuff for like my whole life, but I'm definitely learning new things all the time from writing it. So that's really exciting for me too.
Great. I'm really looking forward to that. We need something injected into that space. So I'm excited.
Yeah. And the fact that it's going to be with Beacon is amazing because like they published Audre Lorde and James Baldwin and like Ralph Waldo Emerson. And so I kind of like to bring this book to that list, which I mean, first of all, Audre Lorde and James Baldwin would be totally down with this book.
Yes, yes.
Right. Probably Emerson would be too, for all we know. But yeah, it's kind of an amazing place to be able to be on that list.
Okay, I could talk to you forever, but we've got to, you know, time is not infinite.
Love is an infinite resource. Now we're going to say the thing. We're going to say the ethical non-monogamous thing.
Okay, love is an infinite resource, but time is finite. Okay, so I want to remind people that the book is called I Live in the Country and Other Dirty Poems. It's from Four Way Books. You can support the publisher by going directly to their website to buy it at Four Way Books, the word four, not the number, fourwaybooks.com. Because I really want to encourage you to support small presses, independent bookstores, all that good stuff. You can find Ariel on Instagram and Facebook at Ariel_Greenberg. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's really such a thrill and pleasure, and your work has meant so much to me, so it's just delightful to be able to talk to you.
Thanks. I want to thank also my editor and engineer, A-Rod at FTC Designs. He's on Twitter at FTC_designs. I'm on social media at Tristan Taramino. The podcast goes up, which is weekly, goes up every Monday on all the podcast platforms. And until next time, everyone, take some time to talk about sex out loud.